Robin Hood Radio and the Robin Hood Radio Network is proud to present Leonard Lopate at Large, lively hour-long in-depth discussions providing overviews and context to topics usually covered in partial measures. His guests include leading thinkers, scientists, artists, economists, farmers, historians, authors, and politicians. Mr. Lopate is a Peabody Award winner whose numerous honors include 3 Associated Press Awards and 3 James Beard Awards.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. The number of people in the United States who have been exonerated after serving time for crimes they didn't commit has been rising every year. Some high-profile cases, like the Central Park Five, get a lot of publicity, but the vast majority of innocent people who've been convicted of crimes are never identified and cleared. Lonnie Suri, who manages media relations and public policy strategies in high-profile legal cases involving wrongful convictions, joins us now, along with one of his clients, Derek Hamilton, who served 20 years in prison for murder before his conviction was overturned. Derek now works as a legal and wrongful conviction advocate. They're here to discuss false confessions, government misconduct, and why progressive civil rights groups don't get involved with issues involving wrongful convictions. Welcome to our show.
Hey, thank you very much for having us.
Absolutely. Lonnie, can you tell us a bit about your background? When did you become interested in criminal justice?
I went to school at the University of Buffalo in the early 70s and was there.
That explains a lot.
Really, many years ago. And I was there when the Attica uprising took place. And Attica is just 50 miles outside of Buffalo. And we were then, it was the anti-war movement, and the activists were very concerned. The law school and friends of ours in Buffalo were very concerned. We knew the Buffalo police. We knew the New York State police. We, as Vietnam War activists, we knew how they reacted. And we were very concerned about what could possibly happen in Attica with the inmates who were demanding, you know, basic human rights. There were negotiations on. David Rothenberg, who many of your listeners know, was one of the negotiators. Bobby Seale, writers. And so we went out there. We went out to Attica, 100 of us, to stand witness, you know, to what could possibly happen, which happened. And unfortunately, we were literally chased out of town and told we were going to be attacked if we didn't leave. And within a day or two, the police came in, the New York State Police, and killed upwards of 50 people, including 10 prison guards. That night in Buffalo, all the newspapers and the newspaper reports, radio reports, had been reporting that the inmates killed the prison guards. Most of us knew that possibly wasn't true. It turned out not to be true. And that began in my sort of interest in criminal justice reform.
But since you're not an attorney, how are you able to help your clients?
I have this unique niche of having a voice. And what happens often in criminal justice and in wrongful conviction cases, especially when it first happens, what I say to legal groups is if you don't have a public strategy in this day and age, as a lawyer, you're committing malpractice. Every day we all open up the local newspapers and see the police blotter. And we have all the names of, you know, Joe Schmo, our neighbor, stole from the farm stand, or things that are much worse. Already your client is convicted in the eyes of the public. And unfortunately, we believe, and many people believe, that the court of public opinion has a tremendous impact even at the time of trial.
So you feel that the media aren't really doing their job in educating the public about these issues?
Well, I think, in fact, the opposite is true. In many high-profile wrongful convictions of many I've worked on, it was the media that helped convict the wrongfully convicted, because the only information that the media was getting was from the prosecutor's office. Attorneys, for the most part, are too afraid to talk and they're intimidated. Family members are told not to talk. So the issues of innocence, the issues in the case that could ameliorate or exculpate the individual, never get out there. The jury only hears what the prosecutor wants. And prosecutors are very, very effective at the narrative. In every wrongful conviction case, high profile, they have a narrative. You know, he was a bad kid. He was jealous of his parents. In Marty Tankleff, a famous case, they said that he didn't want to drive the old Lincoln. in. He was a rich kid. In Derek Hamilton's case, he was a bad guy.
So, Derek, once someone is incarcerated, what legal options are available for someone who's been wrongfully convicted?
Well, I mean, the first thing is an attorney. And the attorney usually is overworked, overburdened, and don't have the resources that he need to help somebody. For me personally, if I didn't have Lonnie Shorey, who I wrote from prison and begged to help me, sent some of my commissary money, I'd probably still be in there.
But don't many people,
that's nice of you to say.
Don't many people who are convicted of a crime claim that they're innocent?
You hear that all the time. I mean, it's the status quo to say that you're innocent. Absolutely. But that doesn't stop the fact that there are large, many people who say they're innocent that are innocent. And if you go to the law library and you see a guy in there every single day working to get out of prison, that's a sign that he's probably innocent.
So, Lonnie, how do you determine that someone might have a valid case?
It's very similar. A colleague of ours who also served 20 years, Marty Tankleff, and I were, after he got out of
prison. We'll talk about the Tankleff
case.
It was
pertinent because we did a talk once, and we came out of the talk, and the media was there, and they stuck a microphone in his face and said, "Doesn't everybody say they're innocent?" And Marty looked at the reporter like he was an idiot, and he said what Derek said. He goes, "No, but a usual sign is if they're working on their case in the law library." What I like to say, and I get letters almost every day from prisoners, letters or packages, and I'm embarrassed to say most I can't open. I can't. It's so painful. But I say to myself, that guy or woman spent money to put a package together, to send to Lonnie Shorey. He didn't or she didn't do that because they're guilty. Now, not everybody is innocent, but there are many, many innocent people behind bars.
Is there any way to estimate the number of wrongful convictions in the United States?
I don't think there is, because you have a lot of people that plead guilty because they're afraid of the criminal justice system, and those people are not being monitored. And that happens every single day. People take pleas, guilty pleas, just to get out of prison.
Large settlements receive a lot of publicity, like what happened with the Central Park Five. They received over $40 million as a settlement. Is financial compensation distributed equitably to everyone who's been exonerated?
Absolutely not. I mean, for me, I had to fight a tooth and nail to get anything out of the city of New York. I think that if they like you, they tend to compensate you quicker and faster and probably more money. If you are a poster child of hate, I think discrimination comes in effect. They don't value your life the way that you value your life. I think that there's no money in the world that can get me back 20 years in prison, or the abuses, the 10 years of special housing unit that I spent. There's no amount of money.
You spent a lot of time in solitary confinement.
Absolutely.
And you didn't even commit the crime.
Absolutely. And I think there's nothing that can give me back graduation with my children that grew up without a father, or the moments to spend that. There's no money in the world that can value that back and give me those moments back. So monetary compensation to me is, it's disparaged like everything else. It's based on whether they believe that you are worth a certain sums of money or not. It's up to an outsider. And it
but doesn't the city is still fighting your case not to pay. They fought in the Central Park Jaga case for years until de Blasio got in. And one of the few things he did on criminal justice was to facilitate the payoff, the settlement in their case. And Derek's case has been pending for years.
There should be some uniform where if you are exonerated, there should be a quick access to some compensation, but the city fights tooth and nail against it.
You would think that financial settlements would deter future wrongful convictions, but since the money often doesn't come, I guess that's not an issue.
$100 million. I think the city has paid $100 million to wrongful convictions just in the last few years.
That really would have helped the MTA, wouldn't it?
Yeah, right.
Once an innocent person is convicted, how often are the actual perpetrators of a crime brought to justice?
I can't give you the statistics, but the Innocence Project have said that in the majority of their cases, they get to the right guy. And they have, I think, about 200 cases or something like that.
Well, they have 330 exonerations, okay. DNA exonerations. Most, you know, that's why wrongful convictions is a victim's issue, because the victims of that crime never get justice. And it's a societal crime because those that committed the crime, in most cases, are in our communities and go on to commit other crimes. I think the Innocence Project estimated that in the number of New York cases, which I think is maybe about 15 or 20, maybe a little more, that in 7 cases, people went on to commit murders and assaults and rapes. The actual perpetrator.
The actual perpetrators, not the ones who went to jail.
So it really is. And the family never gets satisfaction. And that's why in some cases you'll see a family fight to keep the person, even if they know they're wrongfully convicted, because it's so much pain for them.
That's what happened with the Central Park Five. Right. The actual perpetrator committed other crimes, and eventually they put two and two together. But wasn't that also based on DNA evidence? Are most of the wrongfully convicted freed nowadays because of DNA evidence?
I would like to say that there's a big problem with the medical examiners in New York City who has, to me, a vested interest in siding with the prosecutor. As a defense, if we ask the medical examiner today for evidence that can clear our client, they tell us no. They deny us outright and say that it's privacy. But if the prosecutor goes to them and asks, they give it to them. So there's a double standard right there. I mean, we in court right now on numerous occasions fighting the medical examiner to get evidence that we know that we'll exonerate our client. They go so far to say it's missing, it's been destroyed. So I think we need a real independent body of medical examiners that works for both the defense and the prosecutor equally.
But DNA is the one that's most cited. If the case doesn't involve DNA, what other options are available?
Well, I mean, DNA...
Very difficult.
Yes.
Go ahead, Derek. Yeah.
You have ballistics evidence. You have other science, fingerprint evidence.
Or somebody commits a similar crime and they finally figure it out?
Absolutely.
Well, you
or
know,
or admits to the crime?
Well, absolutely. Because, in fact, what happens in a wrongful conviction often is the investigation ends. So there was never a real investigation. Derek got out and was exonerated, not based on DNA evidence, but actual, you know, forensics that they looked at where the bullet go. Now, those prosecutors had that information 25 years ago. They chose not to use it. They only used it after Derek fought and fought and fought, and we went public, and we had articles about Derek's case. Then they finally said, well, we better take a look at it because he's got a big mouth.
Absolutely.
Hey, but in your case, you didn't confess. Why do people confess to a crime that they didn't commit?
Well, I would say, number one, fear. I don't know. You've probably never been in an interrogation room.
I've been the interrogator a few times, but we call that talk radio.
So, I mean, you got to remember, the police officers use all kind of tricks. Mm-hmm. Number one, they make you believe things that's not true. They lie to you, and the Supreme Court has said it's okay for them to lie to you. So once they sit there with a 17-year-old kid, a 16-year-old kid, a 15-year-old kid, somebody that's already afraid, and they put all these things in your mind and say, well, if you just say this, we'll let you out. We're going to let you go. We just need you to say this. A lot of the times people believe the police, and they just say the things thinking they're going to get out of there. And at some point, if you're in a room for a precinct for hours and hours, you're not eating, you're cold, you got no food, you got no phone call, you just want to get out of that room and out of that precinct. If prison is where you got to go, at some point you say, just get me out of here. So it's just the torture. It's kind of like sitting in a place, a foreign place, and you just being badgered and badgered for 20 hours over and over. You get out for a few minutes, you come back, and they keep asking you the same questions. At some point, you say whatever they want you to say just to get the hell away from them. Excuse me.
Well, I actually started a website called falseconfessions.org because all the cases I was working on involved false confessions. According to the Innocence Project, of the 300 DNA exonerations, 63% of those involving a murder involved a false confession. And often the defendant never really confesses. It's not like he held his hand up and said, I did it. He makes statements that, you know, the police will say, well, for example, we found your DNA at the crime scene. And the defendant goes, what are you talking about? Now, this may be somebody who was in the park at the time. So they start thinking, well, you know, maybe I walked by the deceased or maybe something happened. They said, yeah, maybe you walked by the deceased.
So that's considered
incriminating. That's a confession. That's incriminating. And you can go to the jury with it. And in the Miranda v. Arizona, the famous Supreme Court decision in 1966 that established the Miranda, the Supreme Court said that a confession is the most important piece of evidence you could present to a jury.
And I remember a case, I think it was in Washington or in Oregon many years ago, where a daughter under hypnosis came up with an accusation. She said her father had, and a number of his fellow policemen actually, had committed crimes. They were killing babies. And he was suggestible, and he confessed. The others didn't confess. They fought it, and they got out eventually. But because he had confessed, even though obviously he hadn't committed the crime, the the DA's office continued to insist that he stay in prison.
Well, that's they'll continue to insist. And look at the Central Park Five. A friend of mine ran into Linda Fairstein, the infamous or famous prosecutor, or the at a party not too long ago, and mentioned. Well, I said something like, "Well, I guess you know you were wrong," and she goes, "I wasn't wrong." She still maintains that they're guilty. The Central Park Five are
so
guilty.
So does the president.
Yeah, exactly. It's a terrible situation, and so many people confess to crimes they didn't commit. And what will happen, like some of our colleagues, like a gentleman named Shabaka Shakur, who was convicted by Detective Scarsella, the infamous detective, as was Derek.
We'll get into Scarsella,
too. Scarsella went to court and said that Shabaka confessed to him when there was no evidence of a confession. There was no written confession to show. And he just testified, he confessed, and the jury convicted Shabaka of murder.
And despite the fact that the other officer that was there said that Shabaka, in fact, told him that he had an alibi. So when you get a detective that can just say you confess, and there's no checks and balances on whether the confession is reliable or not. A lot of times people confess to things that evidence can prove is unreliable. So they might say, well, you know, I shot the guy in the head and the guy was shot in the chest. Mm-hmm. This is something that's unreliable, and they still accept the confession.
I'm speaking with Derek Hamilton, an exonerated and legal and wrongful conviction advocate, and Lonnie Suri, strategic communications consultant, wrongful conviction advocate. This is Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI New York 99.5 FM. Is it legal for police to lie to suspects, for example, to tell them there is a DNA match when there isn't?
Yes, and in case I worked on 48 Hours, the CBS 48 Hours, interviewed a policeman who got a false confession from one of my clients. And he looked straight into the camera, and the reporter asked him on camera, can you lie? And he goes, yes, the Supreme Court gave me the right to lie. And it was chilling to listen to this detective who was responsible for a young man getting sentenced to 50 years to life, saying it was okay. And they routinely lie. They want to get a confession. Once they get a confession, this is the interesting thing about false confessions, the investigation ends. So in fact, there's no more, like interesting case, this recent case with the young girl who was murdered in Queens, who's, you know, terrible case. The young man was a hung jury the other day. And when I first read about the case, I don't know if he's innocent at all or guilty. But I do know I just listened to some of the information about the case, and he got a confession. And it just, you know, my antenna go up. You know, something's wrong.
Are most people who make false confessions more likely to be those with limited mental capacities and juveniles? Or the guy in Queens was fairly young.
I would say most, but I would say that there's also a large percentage of people that's educated that confess. You got to understand something. When you are in the interrogating room and every trick and every nuisance is being operated against you, it's easy to confess because you thinking at that moment that, look, if I don't tell these people this, I'm going to stand here forever.
Get me out of here.
You know, you just want to get out of there, and you figure justice will come later, that some smart person down the line will realize mm-hmm. that what you said was a lie. And the disparity of cops being able to use what you call ruses to lie to somebody and get them to confess. If the defense did that, the prosecutor would be jumping up and down in court saying, you can't do that. That was unreliable. So, again, the unfairness of the system, man, is designed so people don't get justice.
Yeah, I mean, just in one case I worked on, the three little children were murdered, and they brought this teenager in and who was disabled. So, actually, to answer your question, yes, young people are more likely – and, you know, to confess to crimes they didn't commit. More likely, but not
exclusively. Aren't they supposed to be questioned with a parent or some other adult present?
Supposed to.
Good word, supposed to.
But that was the last thing they want. Anyway, in this case, the police said the three children were murdered. They thought they were murdered at 9 in the morning. So they said to the kid, you killed him at 9, and he's disabled. And he shook his head, and he said, yeah. And then the cops realized the kids were in school at 9 o'clock. So they came back, and they said, you know, and they had this young man in the cell or being interrogated for days. And they came back later that afternoon and said, well, 3 o'clock, you killed him at 3 o'clock. And he said, yeah, 3 o'clock. Then the police realized that the people had seen the kids playing until 8 o'clock. So they came back a third time, and he confessed to killing them at 8 o'clock. And he was sentenced to life in prison, and his co-defendant was sentenced to death.
Was that ever corrected? Did he?
They finally, it was called the West Memphis 3 case, and I worked on it. Damien Eccles, they actually had to take a plea deal in 2011 to get out.
But travesty.
Still convicted. They're still convicted murderers, but they're out.
Travesty.
So that's another thing. You might have been freed, but that doesn't mean that you're not officially a convicted murderer, even though you didn't do it.
Well, that's what Derek talks about, the pleas. I mean, both in the wrongful conviction taking a plea, we don't realize that. In fact, Derek's case made history, and then the court in New York just pushed it back. So about a plea deal.
I want to get to it in a moment, but you brought up the Tankliff case. We often associate wrongful convictions with poor and minority populations, but Marty Tankliff was a middle-class 17-year-old living in Long Island with his parents in 1988. And when he found his mother brutally murdered and his father attacked and in a coma, why did the police focus on him as the only suspect?
He was available. Well, it's a long story in the case, but, you know, Marty was home, and, you know, it's normal to be interviewing somebody, tell us what happened. But they immediately took him to the precinct. They told him that his father, whose father was barely alive, the police told him he was going to take him to the hospital to see his father. What they did was threw him in a precinct cell. And kept asking him, you did it, and he kept denying it. And the police told him that there was a bloody knife found in the kitchen. They told him that they drained all the drains in the house, and they found his blood in the shower. And what was most compelling is they told him that the phone rang in the precinct, in the interrogation room. And Detective McCready picked up the phone and said, yeah. And he said, Marty, they just shot your father with adrenaline. He awoken from his coma, and he said that you attacked him. Now, Marty was thank God, 5'5" and 110 pounds. His father was 6'3". His mother was 5'9". So the cop said to him, and Marty said, what? He must have, the rational answer, Marty said, he was the last person who I saw because Marty was trying to save him. And the cop said, could you have blacked out? And Marty said, I must have.
Well, Marty immediately identified the likely suspect, who his father's bagel store co-partner.
Jerry Stuerman owed Marty's father $550,000 in 1989.
So why wasn't he ever considered a suspect? He seems like a much more reasonable suspect.
There was a lot of drug dealing, a lot of police corruption, and corruption in the district attorney's office in Suffolk County at the time. So there were a lot of reasons. But essentially, they got Marty's confession, and they weren't going to walk away from it. So they had the goods. They knew they can get a conviction. And in fact, that's exactly what they did. And Marty was sentenced to 50 years to life. As I often said, had he actually did it, he probably would have gone to a mental hospital for a few years, but he was sentenced. The judge sentenced him to 50 to life, which was incredible.
How long did he serve?
He served 18 years. Wow. Back to the race issue, and I think in some ways there's no question that race and color and social class plays a tremendous influence in wrongful convictions.
And a lot of other things.
We
see a police shooting almost every day where there's a possibility that the race split was a factor.
Right. But in some ways, wrongful convictions are colorblind because, you know, they don't care. And I'm working with a guy named Richard DiGuglielmo, who's a police officer who's just got parole after 20 years. But he was sentenced to 20 to life for killing a man who was beating his father with a baseball bat. It turns out the man was black. He was an off-duty police officer. Janine Pirro, who many of your listeners may know, she was the prosecutor. And as I like to say, Janine Pirro didn't need the Italian vote. She needed the black vote. So she made it into a race case. And Richie was found guilty and sentenced. And he even got out. And the prosecutor, Janet DeFiore, who's now our head of our Court of Appeals, reinstated his conviction and put him back in jail. He is an Italian cop from New York City. So in his case, race worked the opposite way. But there are many white men and white women who have been wrongfully convicted.
At what point did you become involved in the Marty Tankliff case?
I got a call from a retired police detective named Jay Salpeter, who was a friend of mine. We grew up together. I like to say Jay went to the police academy and I went to the anti-war movement. We had little in common, except we were both Jewish. And 20 years later, he called me up, and Jay was a bit of a savant, and he said, I got a case, a false confession case. I, of course, said, oh, sure. Even then, and I was pretty sophisticated. He goes, no, we need to get the case out of Suffolk County. And I started looking at the case and realized, oh, my God, this kid was sentenced to 50 to life. And I started working on the case.
So what did you do,
a few
PR
days.
Campaign?
Essentially, you know, I was naive to think that I would call the New York Times, we'd get an article, and he'd get out. And this is exactly what happened.
Never.
I called the New York Times. We had a front page article. And 10 years later, he got out. But what that started was we developed essentially a political campaign. We said, and this was 2002, 2003. We set up a website, martytankleff.org. We set up a chat room. This was before Twitter and all those things. But we started this campaign. We looked at our public audience. Any marketing, like running a political campaign, who's our public audiences? Who wants to listen to the case? Who can we help? Who can help us? Most people don't care. But we started with the media. We started with the New York Times. We then got 48 Hours. We met with all the magazine shows. We then got Dr. Phil, who put us our case on. We couldn't get the New York Times. Although the New York Times did 30 articles in the Marty Tankleff case, a guy by the name of Bruce Lambert, who was a City Hall reporter I knew, so I knew somebody to talk. He wrote so many articles we never could get. We always tried to get Bob Herbert to write about it. We never could.
I'm facing the same problem with the Times, which has written a number of defamatory pieces on me. And every time I say, well, why don't you talk to me about it instead of just other people? I get no response.
Yeah. It's amazing what kind of role they play. So that's what we did. We developed a campaign. We went to former judges, former, and I got 35 former U.S. attorneys to sign an amicus brief asking for Marty's case to be overturned.
Now, but imagine, it took a long time.
Imagine trying to get that for a black guy. This is what I'm trying to say to you. And I'll give you a prime example. And we're going to talk about Scott Sutler, as you said.
Later. Wait. I want to hold off on that. We're going to go to a little break. And when we come back, we're going to go through your case in total detail, okay?
We'll get to that.
But meanwhile, Marty is now a lawyer?
Yeah, Marty. Well, it's interesting. The minute he got out and his case was – we could break news here in terms of Cuomo's role in keeping Marty incarcerated. Andrew Cuomo, but that's another story. If we could talk about it later.
You mean he's not
he
a
is
perfect
out.
Governor?
Oh, yeah, right. Well, Marty, the appellate, interesting story. So I have a house out in Suffolk County, and I have a neighbor who was a judge, real curmudgeon, you know, very Republican, very white. And this guy goes, so he goes to me one day, what are you working on? And I said naively, oh, did you ever hear of the Marty Tankle case? You know, I was younger. I had a higher pitched voice. The blood drained from his face, and he said, that kid's innocent. This is a judge. Wow. Everybody knows it, and you'll never get a fair trial in Suffolk County. And I said, what the hell have I gotten myself involved in? He said, this is 6 years before Marty got out. He said, but you'll win in the appellate court. 6 years later, the appellate court ruled 4-0, released Marty. Marty's relatives forced him to go to college the next day, and then forced him to go to law school, and he graduated.
So many of the exonerated wind up going to college and becoming lawyers.
And in fact, Marty's waiting for his bar review, and they're giving him a hard time.
But what about the Suffolk County law enforcement that were involved in the case? Any action ever taken against them?
No, see, what happens is that there's no – people always ask me that. It's sort of like with Detective Scarsella in Brooklyn. Why? People say, Lonnie, do something about Scarsella. There's no law enforcement. There's no district attorney or prosecutorial arm that has any interest in prosecuting or going after politicians because they're all the same party. In Suffolk County, it was Democratic Party had acceded, had they become popular. Cuomo was not going to go after the Democratic Party. Tom Spoda was a Democratic Party DA. So it was clear that they weren't going to find the real killers. And the same thing we find with prosecutors. 100% of prosecutors in this country are elected officials.
You're listening to Leonard Lopate at Large with Lonnie Suri, who's a strategic communications consultant and wrongful conviction advocate, and Derek Hamilton, an exoneree and a legal and wrongful conviction advocate. Derek, you spent time in prison in the 1980s. Is that where you earned a high school equivalency diploma?
Yes, in Elmira Correctional Facility.
So you learned how to conduct legal research. You taught yourself how to do that?
Yeah, as a 17-year-old kid, I was convicted of manslaughter. I was convicted of murder, actually. And I knew that I was railroaded, and I knew that in order to get out of prison, that I had to first educate myself and be my best advocate. I had a lawyer at the time by the name of Candace Kurtz, who gave me a case and said, read this case, young man, so you can understand what's going on with you. I comprehended the case very well. I knew that my rights was being violated, and it inspired me to go to the law library and learn more.
In January 1991, a man named Nathaniel Case was murdered in Bedford-Stuyvesant. Did you know him?
Absolutely. Nathaniel Cash was a friend of mine's. His murder hasn't been solved yet. The police officers know who killed him, and they still haven't arrested anybody for his murder. But he was a very good guy. He was a family man and shouldn't have died like that.
Weren't you in New Haven at the time of the murder? Isn't that a pretty good alibi?
Yes, absolutely. I just knew that they was going to go to New Haven, speak to the people that knew I was there, and that I would be let out. I was certain of that. They had police officers and civilians. Everybody knew that I was in New Haven at the time the crime happened.
And when you were arrested in 1991 for the murder, what did Detective Louis Scarcella say to you?
He kissed me on my cheek, and he said, LGMFA. He was identifying Lafayette Garden Housing Project, which I grew up. But when he was in the precinct, he told me that he had five people that could identify me as being the person that killed Nathaniel Cash. And I told him that was a lie because I was in New Haven where he picked me up at. But he was trying to convince me that I was a killer and that I killed Mr. Cash.
Trying to convince you of it.
Yeah, he absolutely tried to convince me to agree with him.
What were some of the inconsistencies at your trial? Why were the affidavits from your alibi witnesses barred?
What happened was that the judge refused to allow my lawyer a continuance to get the witnesses in. The main alibi was Mr. Cash's child's mother, who had indicated that she was threatened by the police officers and friends of Mr. Cash, that if she came into court that she would be harmed. We asked for a continuance to get in court. The judge denied it. The other alibi was in Connecticut and couldn't get there because of medical reasons. But we asked the judge for just 2 days, and he refused to give it to us.
So Louis Scarcella isn't the only person who is responsible for this miscarriage of justice. The judge as well.
Oh, the judge.
Why do you think the judge was so adamant about not allowing you to defend yourself?
Well, you know, this judge was Edward Rappaport, and if you learn anything about him, Democratic Party line. You know, they got a party line there, and they tend to go with their friends. Michael Vecchione and people in the district attorney's office, Charles Hines and them, was friends of his, not friends of mine. I had no constituencies that voted for judges. So I was the outcast there. You know, I was
a 17-year-old kid. You couldn't even vote.
Nobody cared about me. And at the end of the day, they said I was a bad guy, that I deserved to go to jail. And he sided up with them. He gave me numerous hearings and said numerous times that he can release me, that the evidence in my case was unreliable. But I was always sent back to prison.
Wasn't your main accuser, Jewel Smith, the girlfriend of the victim, Nathaniel Cash?
Absolutely.
So why did she change her story to the point where she actually helped get you convicted?
Well, when I tell you about interrogation room, it don't just apply to people accused of crimes. It applies to witnesses as well. Ms. Smith originally told the cops that she wasn't present when Mr. Cash was shot and killed. She was at a store around the corner. When she came back, she found him there lying dead. They took her to the precinct and told Ms. Smith that she would go to jail for the murder unless she implicated me in the crime. This is a fact that came out that the judge heard from Ms. Smith. He actually, in fact, heard the detective admit that Ms. Smith was beaten up, accused of being involved in and or responsible for the murder before she changed her story to me. And Ms. Smith's own words, she was told that, Smith, you'll never see your kids again. You will never see your kids again. She said it was like a play. They told her what to say, and she came in and said it. So, I mean, it's the police officers. Again, when you got a human being in the interrogation room and you scared them to death, they're going to say whatever you want them to say. We had a case of Kevin Smith where they kept a witness 5 days. And every day they would go back to the witness and say, are you ready to change your story? The witness came before the court and said, I've never seen a murder. This guy didn't do it. The judge auto-ordered him, released him on his own recognizance. But they locked the witness up as the court was leaving and said, whenever you're ready to change your story, we will we hold you in prison tonight. But guess what?
Well, they charged him with perjury
and he
for
got
telling the truth.
And they got a continuance to keep that witness in jail for 5 days. I couldn't get one to call a witness. So that's the disparity you get when you talk about injustice as it relates to black people in America.
You think this only applies to black people? Obviously, we said Marty Tankleff, but you think it's more likely to occur?
I think it applies to everybody. But when I go to prison, the 80% of people that I see walking down that chow line is people that look like me, you know, and that's what I'm talking about. But the interrogation room equally applies to witnesses and accusers. When the police officers have tunnel vision, when they hone in on a person, right, anybody that goes against that is an enemy. So if you're a witness and you come in and say that person didn't do it, they're going to say, hold on a minute.
Now, why did you spend so much time in solitary confinement? After all, you weren't guilty of this crime. They usually only send troublemakers to solitary.
I was an advocate. You know, I was a litigator in prison. I wrote up grievances. I complained about the injustices of the prison scenes. And whenever you're a litigator and you file grievances and you file Article 78s against the administrative bodies, you labeled as a person
not
that
popular. Right? Yeah,
yeah.
So, but there were others. There's a group called the Actual Innocence, the AI team.
That was my team. Mm. You know, there was people that, and a lot of them went to the box too. Shabaka Shakur, Danny Rincon, all of them had their terms in the box. Trust me.
You file grievances with the prison in order to protest the unfair treatment you're receiving?
Absolutely.
And that just made things worse?
Made them absolutely worse. Mm. They would retaliate. I mean, you got to remember who you're talking about. You're talking about people from upstate who don't think you should challenge their authority.
And then Jewel Smith came forward and explained that she'd been coerced by Detective Scarsella into falsely identifying you. What happened after that?
Well, of course, Detective Scarsella came in and said that she was a liar, which I was happy about because I've been saying she was a liar all the time. And they brought the actual detective who spoke to Jewel Smith in, who admitted that Jewel Smith, in fact, had told him she didn't see the crime, which the jury never heard. Judge Rappaport blamed me. He said that Jewel Smith recantation had to be manipulated by me or somebody acting for me. He actually said that I was coordinating strings and like a master puppeteer.
You were pulling the strings, not Louis Scarsella.
From Rikers Island. I was pulling these strings from Rikers Island. They had to be very long strings.
Bloody, how did you meet Derek?
Well, I was at my desk one day in my office, and I had been still working on the Marty Tankleff case, and I had a business actually, you know, that actually paid me, and so I had clients who would get mad at me when they'd see Marty Tankleff in the newspaper because they'd say, "You're not I'm paying you for my case, not my case. I'm paying you for my business." So I was working on that. I was working on the West Memphis 3 case, and Derek Hamilton, through his wife, calls me and asks me for help. And I said, I'm just too busy. I can't help you. And, you know, within a week or so, I get a check written. I get a letter from the Auburn Correctional Facility and a check on the commissary account.
$5, no money.
No, it was more than that. And I looked at it and I said, oh, this guy really, now he's got me.
You know? Now you're still
I couldn't get away from him.
Aren't you still working on the West Memphis 3 case?
We've gotten them out, but they're still. You know, they're still, and I am still working on the case. But what happened was Derek, and then, well, so Derek then called me, and he had a group of people like Danny Rincon, and who else was in the group?
It was Nelson Cruz.
Nelson Cruz, who's still incarcerated. Danny Rincon is still incarcerated.
Shabaka Shakur, who's out.
So they called me and said, what can we do? How can we raise the profile of the case? In Derek's case, he had sent me his files. So I had a little room in my office that was Derek's files, and we started reinvesting his case. Derek at the time didn't have a lawyer. So I brought a private detective in. We sent him up to get fresh affidavits. I made calls. I called a kid named Tasim Douglas, who was an eyewitness to his account. So we started building a case. And then Derek finally got some lawyers, and that led to his ultimate. And he was paroled. Derek was not released.
You were released on parole in 2011 after serving 20 years. But do you think that was an admission that a mistake had been made?
Absolutely. Yeah,
but it's not an official exoneration?
Right. The parole board didn't have the power to clear me. But what they did was say that we wish you well in exonerating yourself. So they gave me the free reins to get out and to be able to fight my conviction.
And tell us about your most significant legal victory, People versus Hamilton in 2014.
Yes, yes. Jonathan Edelstein and Bobby Grossman were two attorneys that worked on that case. And we was able to convince the appellate division that there should be a freestanding claim of actual innocence in New York. With procedural bars, don't stop a person from having the merits of the innocence claim heard. In reference to In re Troy Davis Supreme Court case that said that the same thing. So he was able to make law on that.
And in fact, what happens is most, and in Derek's case is a perfect example, most people that are fighting their wrongful convictions file, you know, 440s they're called, motions to reopen the case, and they're routinely denied. And then the judge will say, well, that was considered a year ago in the last case.
Right.
So I'm not going to, you know, even though it's evidence of innocence. So Derek's case was landmark, and it removes some of those barriers, and actual, you know, innocence becomes the most important thing. Although the state court of appeals has pushed it back, unfortunately.
All right. Judges look for ways to overcome post conviction motions. So the first thing they do is look to deny your motion. So basically, what this did was say, look, you just can't just throw this motion in the garbage or throw the evidence in the garbage if there's a colorable claim of innocence. So the fear that anybody can raise an innocence claim goes away because you need a threshold of evidence. You need a lot of evidence, prima facie evidence. So, I mean,
but isn't there a lot of evidence in regard to Detective Scarsella? The New York Times published a story in 2013 about him detailing a long history of falsifying confessions, coercing witnesses, planting evidence. I would think that any judge looking at that would say, oh, something's fishy here.
And Derek was instrumental in getting that story in the New York Times with Francis Robles, the reporter.
So there was a review by the DA's office of every homicide case that Scarsella had worked on. What happened as a result?
I think 16 people to date have been
16?
Exonerated. I believe it's like 16.
Yeah, but what he retired in 1999 after 26 years on the force as a highly decorated detective. Can he be prosecuted now for any of these things?
Unfortunately, the statute of limitations prohibit him from being arrested in New York, but the Justice Department can look at these cases and bring him to light tomorrow. I think what he did was more than just Scarsella. I believe that there was a conspiracy. There was a systemic problem with police and prosecutors.
Charles Hines'
right,
office.
Who was just looking to close cases and then send people to jail without justice being at the forefront.
And Scarsella, there's been many cases, I think, as Derek said, 16 cases, many of which have gone before judges recently in Scarsella cases. Scarsella's been called to testify. He's lying in the courtroom. If there was a prosecutor that had any cojones, they would prosecute him.
For perjury.
Absolutely.
Now, would they win? We don't know. Can they prove it? But nobody's interested in it. And the police department, which is a great disappointment, have just given him awards.
Now, up until DNA evidence became widely available, eyewitness testimony was the ultimate decider. Why are eyewitnesses so confident that their memory is accurate when they're identifying a suspect?
I would like to say that police officers, we go back to the cop. I mean, if a cop come to you and say, we got the guy that shot your brother, right? You're going to believe that this cop's investigation found the guy. They suggest to witnesses who committed the crime. Sometimes they even pick the person out. The guy in seat three was the guy that did it. Take a good look at seat three.
You mean when they have a lineup,
when they say,
check out the one in seat three rather than just saying,
the guy that looks
and show up. In a case that we have, the cop actually told the witness who was the guilty party. And we need you to come in and corroborate that. This happened in Nelson Cruz case. A cop told the guy, said, look, Nelson Cruz committed a crime. Somebody else identified. We just need your help to finish this guy off.
Now there are these double-blind procedures in live police lineups and photo arrays.
Well, they're the two largest causes of wrongful convictions, in addition to discovery, which is prosecutors not turning over evidence to the defense, is false confessions and police interrogations that result in confessions, and what I call misidentification. And a new law that was just passed, and one of the few things that Andrew Cuomo has done, I'd like to say, in criminal justice reform, is he actually signed the law, which mandates recording of interrogations in New York State and mandates double-blind police lineups. So the police officer who is working on the case can't sit there and say to the defendant, so ostensibly a person who doesn't know anything about the case should be leading it.
But New York is behind New Jersey and Connecticut.
Oh, way behind. New York just passed that. And it's very interesting.
New York is considered a progressive state.
New
Why
York
does it have one of the
one
highest
of the
rates
least,
of wrongful conviction?
One of the least progressive states. Let me just say this. New York State is one of the least progressive states in the country. It stands behind places like Texas and other states in criminal justice reform. It's one of the states with the most wrongful convictions. And right now, there are laws in the state legislature on discovery reform that is so important because prosecutors can withhold evidence up until the night before trial. So no witnesses. For instance, if there's a witness testifying against you, the defendant doesn't know who that witness is until maybe 24 hours or very. So how do you do due diligence? How do you find out evidence? And New York is the worst in discovery reform, and that has to change. And Cuomo needs to pass the bill.
Derek, did you go to the NAACP or some other group that promotes criminal justice reform when you were trying to convince people to listen to you?
I wrote to everybody. I wrote everybody you can imagine, every organization.
Did any of them respond? Because one of the things that Lonnie brings up is that these groups actually are not very good. Even Black Lives Matter hasn't been very effective in this regard.
They had no interest whatsoever in assisting me or anybody that I know in trying to get out of prison. What we had to do was form our own group, Dulani, family and friends of the wrongly convicted, and send them to City Hall. We had to send our own families and create
press conferences on the steps of City Hall with hundreds of family members.
And what did Mayor de Blasio come out and join you?
You know, I got to tell you, he's a great disappointment. And I know Bill de Blasio. I've worked with him. I worked in the Dinkins administration. He's a terrific guy, a real progressive. But he has a blind eye towards wrongful convictions. It's not on his agenda. It is not. We are not a constituent that is important. We're not a constituent that it's important to civil rights groups. It's almost as if they think we're guilty.
Why is that, do you think?
You know, it's hard to say. It's almost like they think we're guilty. So, you know, maybe they deserve to be in prison. They just, you know, they haven't adopted this because I don't know, Derek.
I think that they're afraid that we ask them for accountability. So we asking them to do is hold police officers accountable. Right, nobody want to hold anybody accountable for the wrong they do to us, because to them our lives don't matter. So we think the Black Lives Matter would join in with us, because police officers feel that arrest brings them up their stature. Prosecutors believe convictions. Judges believe the faster they get the case off their calendar. But nobody is held accountable. So when you look at a false arrest, right, who's going to be held accountable for that? Nobody. And we asked Bill de Blasio in a letter, right, to pass legislation that hold cops accountable. When Governor Cuomo signed this bill to hold prosecutors accountable, what do? They fought. They got it in court right now saying, oh, no, this is the wrong bill to do. We got immunity. So anytime you ask somebody to hold somebody accountable, their constituents, which is police officers, vote for mayors, right? They say, oh, we don't want the police officers to be against us. Prosecutors vote for mayors. We don't want them to be against us.
Well, they got the whole union thing.
Right. You see? So they're afraid of that.
And the NYPD is a real disappointment as well. And, you know, we have some of the – we've met with the NYPD officials. We talked about it. It's just not part of their world, and it should be, because they could be – NYPD can be really helpful in terms of wrongful convictions, almost like the cold case squad. Yeah. So we called on the NYPD to open up a cold case squad. I'll invite us to speak to their school, you know, the training, when they train new officers. But it fell on a deaf ear. They're good people. I know the leadership of the NYPD, but it's like they're stone deaf.
In the case of Scarsella, obviously, the more cases he was given credit for solving, the higher up he went, I guess he got pay raises and the like. But what is in it for the judge or the prosecutor? Just get these things through as quickly as possible?
There's a number of things, but when Damien Echols in the West Memphis 3 case, when he got off of death row, he and I were speaking to a legal group, and they asked him, how did you get wrongfully convicted? I was about to give a long answer. He used one word, ambition. And I was like, what does he mean? And he went on to say the police became police chiefs became prosecutors, prosecutors became judges, and the judges became senators on my death row sentence. And it was apocryphal, or was that the word? Yes. But it was so true, because ambition, you don't get ahead by freeing the innocent.
And you got to remember, judges are being told that the person who stands before them accused are a terrible guy, right? They're being told that this person threatened witnesses, this person is a killer. If you sign your name to releasing this guy, it's going to come back to haunt you, judge. And they don't want to get the backlash of letting somebody they think a guilty person go. Public safety is a judge's number one thing. So he's believing the hype that comes from prosecutors. He's thinking, in my case, the judge didn't believe that the prosecutor would lie to him. And when he found out they did, he seemed like he was shocked. But he still didn't do anything about it.
What kind of work do you do now as a legal assistant?
I'm a paralegal from Justice Bonus and a few other attorneys in New York City.
Didn't you meet recently with the Brooklyn District Attorney's Office?
Yes, we have meetings on a regular basis.
To talk about certain cases?
Yes, yes. We ask them to give people justice that we think injustices happen.
Well, didn't they look at reducing sentences?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Derek is being modest. I mean, he is leading an effort with helping wrongfully convicted and is a legal extraordinaire. He is really more than brilliant, actually.
I would say that I'm a very good advocate. Eric Gonzalez has an ear to lowering the sentences of people that got some astronomical sentences based on minor crimes. You know, we got a guy that was charged of burglarizing an abandoned building that will die in prison if this sentence is not reduced. We got another guy that has life in the federal from a 17-year-old conviction. Now, we all know that the Supreme Court has ruled one thing right, that juveniles should not be charged as adults because their brainwave is not great. But you have so many people from crimes when they was 15, 16, and 17 now languishing in prison, and I'm trying to change some of that.
And the Human Rights Organization, Human Rights Watch, also points out that the elderly prisoners
yes.
are very unlikely mm-hmm. to go out and commit crimes.
Absolutely.
So if they have a life sentence or if,
right.
they if you let them out at 85, you're really just saving the public a lot of money.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Criminal justice reform is so on the back burner. Now, it is before Congress. There's a fairly weak bill, but there is a bill that the Senate is about to consider that will make some changes. It's really more, you know, to reduce some sentences and get good time and things like that. There was a much stronger bill that was before the House that was never made it through the House.
Surprise.
And there are laws in New York State. But the biggest thing, I think, is prosecutorial accountability.
Yeah.
If you're not going to pay for lying, if you're going to hide evidence, if you're, you know, going to do things that are going to lead to wrongful convictions, you need to pay for it. And until you do, as a policeman or as a prosecutor, nothing will change.
Do you keep in touch with the men from your actual innocence team in prison?
Absolutely. Danny Rincon is a guy who can't sleep over at night. Guy who we know.
How long has he been sentenced?
He got 100-something years, man, for murders that we know he didn't commit. The judge in his case created a whole new theory in order to deny his post-conviction motion. Said there was another group of shooters that never was identified by anybody. And judges do that to keep you in prison. But I keep in touch with him. Nelson Cruz, we got a post-conviction hearing set up for him December 13th before Judge Simpson in Brooklyn. We asked that any supporters come out for him. There's a slew of other guys. Manny Lugo, a guy out the Bronx, the real killers confessed to the crime, admitted to it.
That wasn't enough?
It wasn't enough.
Right. And he was sentenced to 40 to life?
And the real killers.
How about John Juca?
John Juca is a case where his mother was so brave that she went out and got the jury to admit that there was bias against him. His case has been overturned by the appellate division, and he still sits in prison right now.
Because they wouldn't grant him parole, even after the appellate division ruled 4-0 to free John Juca.
Right.
And then there's John Adrian Velasquez. These are guys.
But what reason would they give for not freeing him after that?
You know, it's almost shocking because the prosecutors fight. They never give up. We have a young man named Sunday Moses who we work with as part of Families of the Wrongfully Convicted and Kevin Smith. And we went through a hearing and the prosecutor thought they were Perry Mason. There was so much. It was a slam dunk. There was no question. There was so much evidence
right.
that he was innocent. But you'd think the prosecutor was auditioning for a television appearance.
Absolutely.
Maybe they were. So there's this again, you don't get ahead by freeing the innocent.
Actually, I think there would be a good reality show, don't you?
Hey,
freeing the innocent.
Freeing the innocent. But the reality is there's a lot of people that's suffering in prison, man. You know, it's one thing if a person is guilty.
But you must feel scarred from having been in prison for so long for something you didn't do.
Deeply.
You lost a lot of years of your life.
And a lot of family members. I'm deeply scarred. And the scars don't go away.
20 years?
Right, because there's so many other people like me. See, when I get a letter from somebody that says that they're innocent, it brings back nostalgia. It makes me remember all the letters I wrote and many people that didn't answer.
And I thank you both so much for being on our show. Derek Hamilton, an exoneree and a legal and wrongful conviction advocate, and Lonnie Suri, strategic communications consultant and wrongful conviction advocate.
Leonard, thank you very much.
Thanks for having us.
And that brings us to the end of our show. My great thanks to Lonnie Suri and Derek Hamilton, to Deborah Freeman, who produced today's segment, to Reggie Johnson, who is at the audio controls, to Charlie Morrow, who composed our theme music, and to my producer, Jesse Lent, who helps make things run smoothly. Leonard Lopate at Large comes to you on Saturdays at 4 and Tuesdays at noon. You can subscribe to Leonard Lopate at Large podcast on iTunes and by clicking on Robin Hood Radio's archive program site, which is robinhoodradio.com. You can also check out Leonard Lopate at Large Facebook page. We hope to see you next week.